listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Take no prisoners. The State Department's hostage point man, Roger Karstens, works to free U.S. citizens from captivity, whether they're being held by Vladimir Putin or Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. Adam Sierowski embeds with America's top negotiators through 15 months of rescue efforts with the highest of stakes, liberty or death. Opening photograph by Norman Jean Roy. Man with a plan, Roger Karstens, special presidential envoy for hostage affairs near the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. Part 1. At dawn on October 1st, 2022, Usman Khan was roused from his cell inside Venezuela's notorious subterranean prison known as the House of Dreams. Khan was a fresh-faced Floridian, all of 24 and barely out of college. 9 months before, he had made the fateful mistake of crossing the border into Venezuela to meet his girlfriend's family, only to find himself in the clutches of one of the dictatorship's dreaded security services. For weeks, his interrogators subjected him to torture of all kinds: waterboarding, electric shocks, beatings, stress positions, extreme confinement, and forced injections, which his family says induced grand mal seizures. One of his torturers went by the nickname the Piranha. Khan was incarcerated in a pariah state beset by gangs, rampant corruption, and humanitarian crises, a country that considered his homeland a mortal enemy. It was hell, recalled his sister Yasmin, who, while finishing her master's at Georgetown, was putting in long hours as Khan's advocate in Washington. His incarceration had enveloped the close-knit family. "My mom is the strongest person ever," said Jasmine, "but it definitely broke her. She was telling me, if something happens to me, it's your job to get your brother out." She was thinking of committing suicide. Khan had already tried to take his own life, but his captors had intervened. The Venezuelans alleged that Khan was not what he claimed to be, a love-struck young man who had innocently entered their nation. Instead, they maintained, he was a CIA assassin dispatched to kill President Nicolas Maduro, who in 2013, after the death of his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, had wrested control of the beleaguered oil-rich nation, going on to establish a ruthless far-left dictatorship. As evidence, Khan's minders produced a Google map printout of Miraflores, Venezuela's White House, which they claimed to have found among his possessions. "The only thing Usman could assassinate is a hamburger," recounted Matthew Heath, a 42-year-old retired Marine from Tennessee who had been in custody for more than a year by the time Khan appeared. "Casa de los Sueños is a funny name because it sounds like daycare," Heath observed. "Oh, the House of Dreams, I'll drop the kids off. But only a terrorist or a hardened criminal would have any kind of preparation to be in a place like that." Heath, with his southern twang, slicked back white hair, and translucent blue eyes, formed an unlikely bond with Khan, a Cuban-Pakistani-American, whom Heath treated like a kid brother, sharing food and clothing. Heath also shared something just as valuable: lessons he had learned in survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, or SEER school. Heath was no ordinary grunt. Having received specialized training and taken part in sensitive military missions, he had become a habitual headache for his captors. He acted irrationally and unpredictably, defying orders and going out of his way to keep his jailers confused and irritated, all in a bid to improve his conditions. "I'm going to do whatever I can to ruin the day for the guys working at the prison," he told me. He advised Khan to resist on his own terms, tapping into his inner reserves of defiance. Heath characterized his own methodology this way. "I went with the North Korea option. I would be randomly and extremely violent. At any provocation, I made a big deal out of it. If they tried to mess with me, it's going to end up with me probably in the infirmary." That's exactly where Heath landed after staging what he later termed a mock suicide in late June 2022, slicing a forearm so that it bled enough to terrify his jailers, but not enough to kill him. He wound up in a military hospital while Khan remained behind in the House of Dreams, where he, in turn, paid forward Heath's kindness and shared the gospel of resistance with a more recent American arrival, a lawyer named Evan Hernandez. Hernandez's imprisonment was not only cruel and unusual, but also deeply ironic. Incarcerated by a far-left government, the 45-year-old from South Central had spent years representing the poor and working class as an L.A. County public defender. In his spare time, he was an avid bachata dancer and a rabid Raiders fan. Yet his Venezuelan guards, for all their socialist swagger, refused to regard the Salvadoran-born American as anything but a subversive. In March 2022, they picked him up near the Colombian border, where, his family said, the unmarried man had been helping a female friend sort out her immigration paperwork, and then deposited him at the House of Dreams. He was charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. "This place is meant to break you psychologically and spiritually," Hernandez said of his surroundings in a voice memo left on his brother's phone. A message meant for President Joe Biden. "The uncertainty, the isolation, the daily human rights violations are taking their toll and are having their intended effect on us. Two people have already tried to commit suicide, and one is on the brink." Imploring the leader of the free world to act, his message ended ominously. "If you don't get us out soon, then there might not be anyone left to save." There are now nearly 40 Americans held in a half dozen countries, citizens, U.S. officials, are working to free. They include well-known cases, like the 5 American nationals believed to be alive in Gaza, as well as former Marine Paul Whelan and Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, both imprisoned in Russia on specious espionage charges. Other high-profile detainees have been successfully recovered. In December 2022, WNBA star Brittany Griner, having been sentenced to 9 years in a Russian penal colony for possessing cannabis oil, was released in a trade for convicted arms trafficker Victor Boot. Last September, 5 detainees held on a variety of charges that the Biden administration labeled as spurious were released from custody in Iran in exchange for 5 Iranians held in the U.S., and $6 billion in frozen funds, to which Tehran would be granted access for use in humanitarian efforts. According to the State Department, the money transferred to restricted accounts in Qatar was effectively blocked from Iranian access after Hamas, an Iran-backed U.S.-designated terrorist group, went on its killing and kidnapping spree. Next photo, all the right moves. Karsten's en route to free U.S. detainees rehearses the handover using chocolates and cell phones, 2022. "For years, I had followed the cases of Americans in peril, but from afar, first while working as a CIA lawyer and later as a journalist and filmmaker covering national security affairs. Still, the back-channel negotiations, the shape-shifting intermediaries, and the multi-pronged maneuvers to liberate U.S. detainees were just not on my radar. That is, until August 2022, when I met Roger Karstens at a rooftop bar in Foggy Bottom. I had known Karstens, 59, since the late aughts, when I was working in TV news and he was cooling his heels at a Washington think tank. Gregarious and good-looking, he had graduated from West Point in the fabled class of 86. Two of his fellow cadets, Mike Pompeo and Mark Esper, would later become Donald Trump's Secretaries of State and Defense. Pompeo also served a stint as CIA director. Karstens, who bears a passing resemblance to Hugh Jackman, was class president at the U.S. Military Academy and a bit of a rebel. At West Point, I had the distinct honor of being a century man. I walked 158 punishment tours, he says, of the misconduct infractions that found him pacing the quadrangle for hours on weekends in dress uniform carrying a rifle. Eventually, he got with the program, rising through the ranks of special forces and making Zelig-like appearances in war zones on four continents. He then took a break to study the great books before returning to government as a deputy assistant secretary at the State Department. To hear Karstens tell it, his career first took shape when, as an 11-year-old in Spokane, he read about the Cambodian genocide, learning how the world stood by as some 2 million perished in the Khmer Rouge's killing fields. Raised in a Christian home where the Bible was a staple, he was determined to make a difference in the lives of the less fortunate. In time, he came to regard the U.S. Army as the most successful human rights organization in history when it comes to liberating vulnerable people. It's what took him to West Point, and later to Special Forces, where the motto is De Oppresso Liber, free the oppressed. By the time we connected for drinks, Karstens had assumed a new title, Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, SPEHA, and an awesome responsibility, retrieving Americans who are wrongfully detained by nation states or held hostage by terrorist groups or criminal syndicates. For decades, pearl-clutching policymakers have proclaimed that the United States does not negotiate with terrorists or hostage takers. But in his role, Karstens is uniquely empowered to bargain with and browbeat as many militants, despots, and assorted ne'er-do-wells as necessary. He now held a job that, in its way, embodied the last line of the soldier's creed, "I will never leave a fallen comrade." Since 2020, under Trump and now Biden, Karstens has helped repatriate scores of citizens languishing abroad. His modus operandi is to engage with anyone and everyone, heads of state, spies, businessmen, clergy, activists, aid workers, even journalists, who might have a bead on or the ability to influence those holding Americans. He is at once patient and impatient, ready to make, rescind, or recalibrate offers, and willing to chase leads and endure setbacks, until, at last, the smallest of openings results in a breakthrough. His big personality masks great faith. I pray a lot for the families, he confided. I pray a lot for the people that are being held. I also pray for the people holding them. I'll lift a dictator up in a second to God and say, Lord, whatever this man is going through, please give him whatever he needs to release our citizens. A special envoy, Karstens spends hours every day on family engagement, calls, emails, text. These are not easy interactions, since he is both the face of and the whipping boy for the government's hostage-related efforts. Things that may not be his fault are nevertheless his problem. The bottom line for my office and this president and secretary of state, he told me, is that if you have a blue passport and you are wrongfully detained or held hostage, your country's coming to get you. What had caught my attention at the bar, though, was a single data point he mentioned in passing. Nearly a quarter of his caseload, he said, involved Americans detained in one country, Venezuela. I knew that Maduro had turned the country into such an abject disaster that more than 6 million people had fled in recent years, with untold numbers streaming across the southern U.S. border. but I found it simply baffling that Majuro, a bus driver turned strongman, upon whom the U.S. has placed a $15 million bounty, was holding more American captives than his worldlier and more practiced patrons in Havana, Moscow, and Tehran. The more I learned, the more I wondered. How had Majuro's House of Dreams become a place to warehouse human beings as political pawns? And why wasn't it front page news? I sought permission from the White House and State Department to embed with what they call the hostage enterprise. For well over a year, I traveled to 7 countries, observed negotiations firsthand, witnessed successful and unsuccessful recovery missions, interviewed dozens of officials, as well as former hostages, their families, and those whose loved ones remain detained. This article and a documentary in progress amounts to an inside look at the U.S. government's commitment to freeing hostages, viewed through the prism of Venezuela, a nation whose vast oil reserves make it an outsized player on the regional and international stage. I personally thought the job should have gone to a lawyer, recounted Robert O'Brien, who held the SPEHA post before becoming Trump's 4th and final national security advisor, someone with a high-stakes legal background and a lot of negotiating skills. But I saw Roger's CV, and I met him and was really impressed, and so I urged the president to immediately give him the title of ambassador. Roger's just done a hell of a job, he said. Our adversaries know that this is a guy who could roll up a newspaper and kill you with it. But at the same time, like most Green Berets I've met, he gets along with people. He's a diplomat. He finds common ground. When you're doing these negotiations, even if you've got a thug or a bad guy on the other side of the table, you've got to build rapport to get to the outcome you want. And Roger's very good at doing that. Karstens is the highest-ranking Trump-appointed holdover. Hostage families, who kiddingly refer to him as Captain America, lobbied the incoming president to keep him. If Biden is looking for an issue around which he can build a bipartisan bridge, I can think of none more appropriate than working together for the safe return of Americans held hostage abroad, wrote Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, who himself was unjustly detained in Iran for 544 days. Karstens is the right sort of mission-driven public servant to lead the effort. Countless initiatives are disrupted by the transition from one administration to the next. But with the lives of fellow Americans at stake, politics should not interfere. Critics have long argued that America should not make deals with tyrants and terrorists. Such engagement, they contend, promotes state-sponsored blackmail, helps legitimize malign regimes, and encourages more abductions. Not so, according to recent patterns. Despite the deals the U.S. has made to free hostages, Russia alone, to use grim diplomatic parlance, seems to aggressively restock the pond with Americans. In fact, facilitating the release of U.S. hostages is one of the rare foreign policy initiatives that enjoys widespread support among Republicans and Democrats. Consider this. A congressional resolution last June calling for the Russians to release Gershkovich passed 422-0. In 2021, Biden, who prides himself on trying to reach across the aisle, kept Trump's envoy on the payroll. And his administration has reaped the benefits, obtaining some 45 releases. Despite Trump's criticism of the Griner deal as a one-sided disaster and a stupid and unpatriotic embarrassment for the USA, he has boasted on Truth Social, "I brought 58 hostages home from many different countries, including North Korea, and I never paid anything. They all understood they must let these people come home." Roger simply is unstoppable, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken, as we sat in the opulent treaty room at the State Department, surrounded by portraits of his predecessors. I've rarely, if ever, worked with someone who is so absolutely determined every single morning he wakes up to bring another American home, and who does it with extraordinary energy, extraordinary creativity, always looking for another angle, another idea, something that might work, but also just with incredible humanity. He's fundamentally motivated by the human dimension of this, and you can feel that. It was not always so. The SPEHA position was born of the tragedy of incremental decisions across successive administrations. In March 2007, Robert Levinson, a retired FBI special agent, traveled to Iran's Kish Island, where he somehow became wrapped up in an unsanctioned operation that was linked back to a CIA official who was allegedly fired over the incident. A CIA spokesperson declined to comment on the matter. The details remain murky, but Levinson was abducted, and by the time his death was made public 13 years after his disappearance, he was believed to have been the longest-held hostage in American history. His family was livid at what they perceived as a decade's worth of gaslighting by U.S. officials, who seemed as eager to bury the reasons for his presence in Iran as they were to hide the lack of tools or resolve that might have made a rescue or a trade possible. My dad went over there for his country, and his country failed him, his daughter Sarah Levinson Moriarty insisted, and the people who sent him lied instead of saving him. Because of infighting and lies they told to protect themselves, we couldn't get him home. It was the first of a series of systemic failures. By 2015, those failures were too manifest to ignore. Three U.S. citizens, James Foley, Stephen Sutloff, and Peter Kasich, had been executed on camera by members of the Islamic State. Others, including Kayla Mueller, Warren Weinstein, and Luke Summers, perished in captivity. When you have an outcome that involves Americans being horrifically beheaded, then you know something has to change, recalled Josh Geltzer, who helped overhaul the system on President Barack Obama's watch. He is now the National Security Council legal advisor and deputy White House counsel. The Obama-era review gave rise to the Levinson Act, ratified during the waning months of the Trump administration, which created a hostage recovery unit in the White House that Geltzer has chaired, a fusion cell that sits at FBI headquarters, and Kirsten's shop based at the State Department. The Levinson Act gave families a guidebook, Levinson's daughter said, adding, with a tinge of dark humor, it might well have been called, "So Your Loved One's Been Taken Hostage." The law, which sets forth criteria for designating someone a wrongful detainee, has proven critical, especially at a time when American power overseas is increasingly being challenged. Over the past decade, according to the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, there has been a 175% increase in the number of U.S. nationals detained unjustly. The length of their captivity, on average, has increased by 60%. And that was before Hamas grabbed Americans and took them to Gaza. On a bright fall morning in Miami, a phalanx of officials fanned out across a private aviation facility on the north side of the city's bustling airport. They were an eclectic bunch, whose roles sound like they were written for a TV procedural. A SEER psychologist, flight medics, and hostage recovery specialist. Also on hand was an FBI special agent who had flown in with papers freshly inked by the president. At the helm, dressed in khakis and a white button-down, stood Karstens. Earlier that morning, with little notice, seven Americans were told they were going home. "My last day in Venezuela was surreal, like out of a movie," said Heath, recounting how he had learned he was being set free. "I was woken up by my primary torturer, who gave him the news. A diplomat with a pistol, which is insane to me." Across town, as Khan would tell family, he was handcuffed, hooded, and hustled into a blacked-out van, surrounded by men jabbing him with what felt like rifles. Shortly afterward, the pair were reunited before being driven to an airfield where they found themselves in the company of five members of the so-called CITGO Six. Executives of a Venezuelan-American oil concern who had been held as bargaining chips for more than 5 years, Jose Pereira, Jorge Toledo, Tomeo Vadel, Alirio Zambrano, and Jose Luis Zambrano. The sixth, Gustavo Cardenas, had been released in March 2022 on humanitarian grounds. Before taking their seats aboard a small jet, each detainee was filmed, reciting his name and the day's date, October 1, 2022. In Miami, meanwhile, as pilots finalized their flight plan, Karstens pored over the proof-of-life videos, clips of the Americans made only moments before that the Venezuelans had sent him via an encrypted messaging app. "These trades kind of look like old-school spy swaps," he explained. "You don't want the other side to pull a bait-and-switch, where you think you're getting prisoner A, and instead they send you prisoner X. So there's always a requirement to get face-to-face." The seven men sat idling on a scorching tarmac, but to secure their release, Karstens and Blinken had to persuade Biden to assuage Justice Department concerns and free two drug trafficking cousins known as the Narcos Prinos, who were serving 18-year prison sentences. Their aunt is Venezuela's formidable First Lady, Celia Flores. "These are hard decisions," the Secretary of State acknowledged after showing me a laminated list of American hostages that he keeps in his pocket. "We value the well-being of every citizen, whoever they are, and the government is determined when they're wrongfully detained to bring them home. If another country happens to value a spy or a thug, well, that's the value system they have. Ours is different, and I'll take ours any day." Like Blinken, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was also monitoring the events as Karstens and company departed Miami and headed to Canoan, a tiny island in the Grenadines, for the handover. "The level of tension in all of this is very high because you're just waiting for something to go wrong," recalled Sullivan, who told me that as the pressure mounted that day, he was in his office down the hall from the Oval. "There's deep mistrust on both sides, obviously. That has to be managed and worked through. And then there's attempting both timing and smooth execution. All of that required a steady cadence of updates to us to make sure that we were hitting our marks for each of the elements of this complex choreography." Karstens was aboard the lead aircraft, a gleaming white Gulfstream V with blue stripes. The so-called narco-nephews sat in the rear compartment under the persistent watch of U.S. Marshals. A second American plane was also barreling south, a gray Gulfstream III with a mobile ICU, recognition that things could go sideways. In the forward cabin of his plane, Karstens gathered the team around a large wooden tray table for an 11th-hour briefing. It all felt very Mission Impossible and very meta. A staffer captured his comments on a cell phone. "You know, when I watch these movies and the military guys are planning their operation on a plane to the objective area, I always think that's the most fake thing on earth. You plan the operation like a day or hours ahead. You load your ammunition, then you get on the plane, and you do nothing but sleep. And yet," he joked to break the tension, "here we are, just like a movie, and route to the objective, and we're going to get the plan." Then Karstens got all DIY. Using a couple of cell phones and some colorfully wrapped Ghirardelli chocolates as placeholders for planes and people, he walked through the mechanics and potential pitfalls. "For all we know, it won't be a perfect world, and they'll land like this," he gestured in a way that put the Venezuelan planes behind his own. "So if we don't have visual out of both sides of the windows, just keep adapting." At home in Winter Garden, Florida, Tanya Valdez was worried sick about her son, Osman Khan. "His health was getting worse," she recalled, dabbing her eyes. He was having seizures more often, and he was rushed to the hospital several times. She had sent Karstens an urgent email. I told him that I was afraid that my son would not make it home if they didn't act quickly. In hindsight, Khan's odyssey from the University of Central Florida to a cell in Caracas had the twist of a spy thriller run through Franz Kafka's typewriter. When he graduated in the spring of 2021, COVID restrictions were still in force, so he began working remotely from Colombia. One evening, he was out at a nightclub where he met an 18-year-old waitress. Khan relentlessly pursued her, and they soon became an item. I heard of his girlfriend Rosa in December of 2021, his sister Jasmine recalled. He said that she was a very good person, very caring, very loving. Rosa is a pseudonym meant to protect her identity. The couple moved in together, and on New Year's Eve 2022, Rosa's father paid a visit. By several accounts, he encouraged the young American to do the honorable thing, visit Venezuela and formally introduce himself to Rosa's family. Had Khan presented the plan to his own family, it is unlikely he would have made the trek. I know it's not safe, his mother said. The regime that they have in Venezuela is similar to the one we had in Cuba, so I absolutely wouldn't have approved of him going. His sister was more blunt. I would have put handcuffs on him. Khan posed some obvious questions. Do I need a visa? How will we get there? Is it safe? The answers, according to two sources, did not come from Rosa or her father, but rather from her brother, Johnny, a captain in the Bolivian National Guard of Venezuela, Bolivarian National Guard of Venezuela, who was apparently tight enough with the regime to have served as a bodyguard for the defense minister. Johnny advised Khan that he was welcome to enter without a visa and was exacting about where to cross. Instead of Cucuta, a well-trafficked border town, Johnny recommended, so Khan would tell relatives that they traverse the Arauca River from a faraway village, a trip that required a nausea-inducing overnight bus ride. When they finally arrived, Khan and Rosa joined her father and boarded a decrepit motorized canoe. If Khan was worried, it doesn't show in the video he shot that day, footage that captured him smiling and laughing as he crossed into a country that had been under withering U.S. sanctions for years. As the three disembarked, one of their fellow passengers guided them to a taxi that he appeared to own and started driving. 15 minutes later, at a military checkpoint, the vehicle was pulled out of line. At first, it appeared to be a shakedown. Guards gathered around and rifled through their belongings. That is, until Khan was asked to pull out his passport. All hell broke loose. "He's a gringo! He's a gringo!" shouted gun-toting men, according to multiple accounts of the incident. Khan was held for 3 days in a ramshackle dwelling that reeked of human waste. When I arrive at the house, they take my handcuffs off and I enter, and I don't know what is going on. Khan would later recount to Heath and others. A really big guy comes up to me and he's like, "So, you think you're a tough guy?" and punches me right in the face. I get knocked to the ground. I get thrown onto this gurney and they strap me down. They cover my face, and they start drowning me. I was screaming, and I would just hear laughing. They were waterboarding me. His captors, convinced he was an American spy, took him to another room, where he said they stripped him naked. One of the guys starts pricking me with something. I was screaming, and then I started feeling needles going through my body. They started electrocuting me. I fell to the ground, and I started throwing up. And the guys start making fun of me, and they forced me to eat my own vomit. Soon, he was shoved onto a military plane, flown to Caracas, and taken to the House of Dreams, where he was placed in isolation. Only after he smashed a mirror and tried to cut himself did the guards relent ever so slightly. They opened a slot in his cell door, which allowed him to peer into the corridor and communicate with Matthew Heath and Evan Hernandez. On January 17th, 2022, Khan's sister received a frantic call from their mother. She was like, "Jasmine, I got this voice recording and I need you to listen to it," she remembered. "I hear Osman. He's like, 'Mom, I need something.' And then it cuts out. And I remember immediately thinking my brother is being held hostage." Within hours, the Khans turned their dining room into a command post as family and friends took out their laptops and tried to reconstruct what had happened. Cross-referencing phone numbers with various social media profiles, they identified some of the individuals who were initially holding Khan. They were members of the same outfit to which Rosa's brother, Johnny, belonged. The family tried to reach American officials, but since the U.S. had suspended diplomatic operations in Caracas in March 2019, responsibility for American citizens in the country had fallen to a unit stationed at the U.S. Embassy in neighboring Bogota, Colombia. Next photos, ensemble cast. Secretary of State Antony Blinken released American hostages Matthew Heath and Osman Khan, then National Security Council Senior Director Juan Gonzalez, Pedro Martinez, father of former detainee Evan Hernandez, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The Khans, like other families whose loved ones are taken, were eager for Karstens and his 25-member SPEHA team to take up Osman's case. That, however, required a formal designation by the Secretary of State, based on 11 criteria set forth in the Levinson Act, establishing that the person in question had, in fact, been detained illegally or under false pretenses. In high-profile cases like that of the journals Gershkovich, that process took 2 weeks. For Khan, it took 6 months. The administration is sensitive to allegations of disparate treatment. I know it can be opaque and confusing to people, but these are often not static stories that are frozen in time, Blinken argued. We learn more about the circumstances of someone's detention as time goes on. We see how a particular case evolves, and that is what may in some instances cross the line from a lawful arrest to an arbitrary detention. When Karstens took over in 2020, he and his chief of staff, Carolee Walker, radically restructured the way families were treated and settled on an unconventional approach. Now, when Americans are designated, Karstens and his team fly out to visit their families in their homes. They sit with them. They dine, drink, and cry with them. Before they leave, the families have Karsten's cell phone number and are encouraged to call him and his staff at any hour of the day, and often do. Relatives can also visit the team on the 6th floor of the State Department, where a sitting room adorned with a single white orchid on a small table is reserved for heart-to-heart sessions. To ensure that the group's mission is front of mind, the hallways are lined with pictures of current and former hostages, making it impossible for the staff to get in their offices without encountering their successes and their failures. Another area is dominated by a panel of digital clocks, denoting the times and locations where Americans are at risk. "During one of my visits," they read, "Bamako, Damascus, Tehran, Pyongyang." While the success of a prestige unit like Karstens can breed envy and resentment among counterparts in other offices and agencies, his coterie is generally given a wide berth. That's because other stakeholders seem to dread the strain and drain that come from constant interaction with distraught family members. One frequent refrain in these circles, "Let's let Rogers folks handle that." Team SPIA spends lots of time brainstorming, playing the angles. They vent collectively and console one another when the chance for a release goes up in smoke, or when a detainee's family calls, yelling or sobbing, and says they aren't working fast enough or being sufficiently creative. "Every day I have a Starbucks coffee at my desk, and I'm wearing a suit and tie. I'm thinking, this is total bullshit. Karsten said about certain facets of the gig. If this job turned into what it should be, we would be forward in a full-time negotiation, drinking Red Bull, popping Adderall, until the job gets done. Clearly, the soldier in him can be at odds with diplomacy's demands. At moments like these, he said, he catches himself and realizes, I'm exactly where I need to be. There's someone in a prison waiting for me to get this done and get them out. In a very polarized country, O'Brien told me, bringing American hostages home is one of the things that pulls people together. In his experience, the public is captivated by the phenomenon. I think it's one of those there but for the grace of God that could be me. Jake Sullivan, who assumed O'Brien's position at the White House when Biden took office, professed a similar view. On a day-to-day basis, we're dealing with big structural issues of historic sweep, he said, ticking off examples such as climate change, the war in Ukraine, nuclear proliferation. Trying to resolve cases of individual people and their families is an entirely different kettle of fish. It is about strategy and diplomacy, for sure, but it's mostly about trying to deliver, at a very human level, a result in which you are bringing home somebody and reuniting them with their loved ones. That is not wholesale, that is retail. It's as retail as it gets. Next photo, homeward bound. Karsten's and team reunite with U.S. hostages Khan and Heath on the island of Kanawan, 2022. When the plane door closed in Caracas, Heath and Khan realized that Hernandez had been left behind in the House of Dreams. After 6 months in Venezuelan custody, the public defender had yet to be labeled by the State Department as wrongfully detained, and therefore he was not part of the exchange. Heath and Khan felt enormous survivor's guilt. Upon landing 90 minutes later, Heath worried that given the flight's short duration, they might have only gone as far as Cuba. All the Citgo guys were yelling, and they were so happy, he recalled. I remember telling Osman, we still have time for this to go bad because they didn't turn off the engines, flip a switch, or take off the brakes, and that plane rolls right back out to the runway and we go back to Venezuela. His suspicions were understandable. During takeoff, the senior Venezuelan official, whom Heath describes as his main torturer, had been stationed by the plane's exit with a handgun tucked into his waistband. Ever eager to keep his captors off balance, Heath started the day by threatening to remain a hostage rather than participate in any exchange in which his nemesis had a role. His outburst, part legitimate grievance, part psyops bluster, evidently prompted his tormentor to make himself scarce in a bid to defuse the situation. Yet once Heath and the other Americans were on board, with their hands and feet bound, the senior prison official reappeared. Out on the tarmac, the U.S. delegation followed the tabletop plan they had rehearsed. Karsten's met and conferred with the head of Venezuela's National Assembly, Jorge Rodriguez, a psychiatrist-turned-politician. He is Maduro's fixer, entrusted to engage with avowed enemies like the United States. Wearing a baseball cap and dark glasses, he looked like he was trying hard not to be recognized or photographed. Karsten's invited Rodriguez onto the U.S. plane, he recounted. He had a chance, quickly, to talk with the nephews, make sure that they were okay. Rodriguez then returned the courtesy. When I popped on the plane, they all recognized me, Karsten's added. They all broke out in cheers and screams and shouts of joy. For my part, I wanted to be there with them in spirit, but I still had to count 7 people and make sure the math was right. I remember getting up to Matthew Heath, and I think even at that point I could tell he was still looking for a fight. Karsten's turned to the steely Marine and said, Hey, Matthew, bringing the heat? Shortly thereafter, the swap commenced. U.S. Marshals unshackled the 2 Venezuelans and sent them forward. Then the main guard, as Heath recalled, began barking instructions. Walk off the plane. Walk straight to the other plane. Don't run. Don't deviate to the left or the right. Walk slowly. Do not stop. My fear was like, what if they try to snatch us? What if they try to screw this deal up? As seven Americans took their first steps toward freedom, Kirsten's embraced the moment. I can't tell you, he said, how special it was for me personally just to physically touch someone who was coming off a plane and tell them that it's almost over. No one needed that more than Khan. As he shuffled toward Karsten's, footage captured of the exchange shows him in a catatonic state. He was no longer in the House of Dreams, but he was not out of danger. Sullivan described the atmosphere at the White House as upbeat, but steeped in uncertainty. It was 99.9% great, and then you're like, okay, but we will not fully feel like the mission is complete until their feet are planted on American soil. He went to see his boss. Most of the time, we were in there briefing the president on threats and challenges, on things that require very hard decisions. It's not that often you get to walk into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, you have the opportunity now to give seven families really good news. The hostage families had dialed into a conference call, thinking they were receiving an update from Sullivan when Biden came on the line. We've secured the release of each of your loved ones, he began. They've been through a lot, and we've been working like the devil to make sure that this happens. They're all safe, all seven of them, and they are now in the custody and care of the U.S. government. Sullivan recalled the reaction. Through the speakerphone in the Oval Office, we could just hear some combination of relief and joy and release, and that was an incredibly human, poignant moment. And it's the kind of thing that really sticks with you. In a job that has a lot of tough days, that was a very good day. Over the Caribbean, the scene was less euphoric. Usman Khan had three physical seizures. I'd say two of them were quite bad, remembered Karstens, who accompanied the young man on the G3 with an ICU. What was going through my mind was, we have a medical team here, we're going to get through this. But the other part that I had to reflect on is, what got him to this state? What happened to him during his time in a prison in Venezuela that caused these seizures? Heath, too, was aboard the G3, which was racing toward Kelly Field at Joint Base San Antonio, where American hostages are typically brought and put through a Pentagon program created to treat and reintegrate prisoners of war. I'm worried about Osman, Heath said. I don't know what's going on. Maybe he could die. Heath held Khan's hand, and psychologist Yong Huang rubbed his chest while medics pushed intravenous medications into his system. I was at the base in Texas when word came that a medical emergency had been declared in flight. The recovery mission was so tightly compartmentalized that those around me were scrambling. Maybe 15 people in the whole U.S. government knew that this was about to happen, Karstens would later recollect. So imagine if you're in the Department of Defense and you're getting a call from your buddies at the State Department warning that in the next few hours, seven people are going to be coming in hot from a jail cell in Caracas, some of them with some pretty tough medical situations, and we need help. The G5 landed shortly after 8 p.m., Four of the Citgo executives disembarked and walked toward a hangar where dozens of family members had gathered. As I observed the encounter, something both remarkable and disquieting happened. The men came to a halt, only a few feet from their loved ones. Conditioned by years behind bars, they appeared to wait for permission to cross an invisible barrier. Then a voice shouted, "Go! Go!" And as though a dam broke, the two sides flooded toward each other. The raw emotion of spouses, children, and grandchildren reuniting was overpowering. Still, the joy of freedom was tempered by the wreckage that captivity had wrought. The G3 landed 15 minutes later. and Karstens, Heath, and a fifth Citgo exec climbed off. Medical personnel then carried Khan down the jet stairs on a stretcher. Months later, I showed him footage of that evening. "I don't even recognize myself," he remarked. "I can tell I'm out of it. I don't even look like I'm cognitively there." With great interest and emotion, he watched a video I had captured of Karstens addressing the seven returnees. "On behalf of President Biden and the Secretary of State, welcome home," he began. Cheers broke out. After thanking the families for their tireless work in holding the government accountable, Karstens turned to the newly freed men. "I've been so inspired and impressed by how resilient you've been, how strong you've been. And this is key. None of you ever lost faith in your country. You knew that at one point we were going to come and get you." The cheers grew louder. October 1st, 2022, represented the largest release of U.S. hostages in four decades. But the glow of that day quickly faded, and worry set in. Could the U.S. hostage enterprise repeat the feat and find a way to gain the release of Hernandez and the dozens of others still held elsewhere in unforgiving conditions? Part 2. Under overcast skies, Karsten steered a white Buick rental through the streets of Compton, California, checking his GPS for the home of Henry Martinez, a tattoo artist whose life had been upended when his brother, Evan Hernandez, disappeared in March 2022 while on vacation in Colombia, where he had gone to take a break from his day job as an L.A. public defender. For his first 10 days in country, Hernandez had texted and called his family daily. Then he went dark. "We let it slide for a day," Martinez recalled. "Then the second day came. Maybe his phone's dead." Soon he tried reaching hospitals in Medellin. When that failed, he rang the U.S. Embassy in Bogota, passing along details about the Airbnb his brother had booked. The Colombian police followed up, and a camera phone was rolling as they entered the dwelling. "When they're walking into that door," Martinez choked up, describing what was running through his head as he watched the video, "the worst of the worst, thinking, you know, they'll find a body. And there was no one there. We had heard rumors of an American who might have gone missing around the border region of Colombia and Venezuela." "And Venezuela," Karstens recalled. "I went to see Matthew Heath and Osman Khan, and typically, the Venezuelans will just parade every American that they have in custody and put them in a room with me and let me kind of sort things out. And in one of those meetings, Evan Hernandez showed up." Hernandez, a seasoned lawyer, gave a rapid-fire summation of how he wound up in the House of Dreams. Karsten scribbled furiously in a Moleskine notebook as Hernandez recounted how, during his vacation in Colombia, he had met a Venezuelan woman who asked him to accompany her across the border into her home country to sort out a passport issue. After he and the woman traversed a bridge, armed men demanded his papers and soon hauled him away. Like Khan, he was held locally before being turned over to military intelligence in Caracas. As Karstens entered Martinez's house in Compton, he was received warmly, hugs and all, by a living room full of Hernandez's family, friends, and colleagues in the legal profession. It was clear, though, that the attorney's imprisonment had devastated his loved ones, emotionally and financially, and infuriated his co-workers. "He's somebody who will use every tool available to defend his clients," said Drew Havens, a public defender whom Hernandez had mentored. "Now he's in a situation in Venezuela where he doesn't have any remedies available to him, and he has told me that it's incredibly demoralizing for him just knowing that the values that he's dedicated his life to don't apply in his current situation." Depending on the guards' moods, prisoners in the House of Dreams are allowed to phone home a few times a month. They can only speak in Spanish, and their conversations are monitored by Venezuelan agents. Havens, who sat in on the meeting with Karstens, expressed the belief that there was a solution to his colleague's predicament. The Maduro regime wants Alex Saab. If Alex Saab were to be released, I'm confident that Avon would have been home yesterday. Alex Nain Saab Moran is not a household name, but the Colombian-born businessman has routinely been described as a pivotal figure in helping Venezuela evade sanctions. The U.S. indicted him in 2019 on money laundering charges, and in June 2020, he was detained in Cape Verde during a refueling stop on his way to Iran. O'Brien, Karsten's and Sullivan's predecessor, told me that he and other Trump administration officials were so concerned that operatives from Venezuela or one of its allies would try to spring Saab from custody that they stationed U.S. vessels in the waters off the tiny West African island nation. 16 months later, the Biden Justice Department would extradite Saab to Miami. Within Venezuela, and obviously with the guidance of Nicolas Maduro, Alex Saab was labeled a freedom fighter, explained Mickey Bergman, an associate of the late Bill Richardson, the New Mexico governor and UN ambassador. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.